Attention, pleasure seekers. What if I told you there was a toy that was so iconic that it practically set the standard for all my favorite products? Allow me to introduce or reintroduce to you the Magic Wand. Dubbed the Cadillac of Vibrators, the Magic Wand is more than just a toy. It's a culture icon, a symbol of power and unapologetic pleasure. I mean, do you know any other toys that have been praised in Time magazine? Didn't think so. With a unique rumble that resonates deep within, the Magic Wand Original is not just a product, it's a trusted confidant. And it's a sure thing. Never had an orgasm? Try a Magic Wand. Never given your party a full body massage? Try the Magic Wand. Listen, it's rightfully earned accolades like Vibrator of the Year for decades. I've been so obsessed with my Magic Wand, I even drilled holes in my bedside table so that she's always next to me in case I need her. Well, that was years ago, because now there are multiple iterations of the Magic Wand, allowing you to pick whatever model fits your lifestyle. You can go wireless with the Magic Wand Rechargeable, tiny with the Magic Wand Mini, or micro. Micro's really mini. Or go for variety with the Magic Wand Plush. The best part though, all of them have the same powerful orgasmic rumble that made the original so popular. So if you're ready to make some magic, visit sexwithemily.com/magicwand and discover why the Magic Wand continues to cast a spell on the world. Magic Wand, not just a vibrator, an icon of pleasure.
The honeymoon phase is amazing because, you know, A, we got a nice little neurochemical cocktail backing us up, and B, there's so much excitement just in not knowing somebody and wanting to learn about somebody, you know? So
it's all new. It's all exciting.
Once I explain it in these terms, every couple I meet says, we want more of that. We want that. We're ready for that. We don't have it. How do we get it?
You can never speak badly about yourself. The way that you speak about yourself becomes who you are.
You're listening to Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and I'm here to help you prioritize your pleasure and liberate the conversation around sex. Oh, 2021, we hardly knew ya. Just kidding. We totally did, and we've got the FaceTime sex to prove it. All year long, we've been saving up the very best moments of Sex with Emily so you can walk into 2022 more sex-wise than ever. From squirting to sex dreams, Nikki Glaser to Esther Perel, we're doing a hot flashback of your most talked about episodes. On this show, we've banked the top pieces of sex wisdom from hands-down incredible guests. Discover your dating style, locate the G-spot once and for all, and build your sexual confidence with some of the smartest and funniest voices out there. Before you create your New Year's resolution list, be sure to listen to this one, because I guarantee you, their advice will elevate your 2022. Intentions with Emily. For each episode, join me in setting an intention for the show. I do it, and I encourage you to do the same. So when you're listening, what do you want to get out of the episode? My intention is to have a blast with you. You might listen to a few pieces of advice here and go, oh yeah. And on others, you might say, whoa, I totally missed that one. And that's why we put it all together. So think of it as a sex buffet for one. And let's have some fun. Please rate and review Sex with Emily wherever you listen to the show. We've got tons of articles up at sexwithemily.com, so check those out. And also, check out my YouTube channel for more sex tips and advice. If you want to ask me questions, just call my hotline, 559-TALK-SEX, or 559-825-5739. Leave me your questions there or message me at sexwithemily.com/askemily. All right, everyone, enjoy this episode. Let's start things off with psychotherapist and relationship expert Esther Perel, who discusses the different types of touch and infidelity.
Can we want what we already have is the fundamental question of desire. What is the difference between love and desire? How do they relate, but also how do they conflict? Why is it that the forbidden is so erotic? Why does parenthood deliver such a fatal erotic blow? What is at stake when the very thing that people rely on is the very thing that becomes most fragile? Because we don't think of desire as something that needs to be cultivated, sustained, actively nourished. We think that because in the beginning, for some of us anyway, it's there, it's just going to remain there forever. And the forever keeps on getting longer.
Exactly.
That's the crisis of desire.
God. We had to get married. We became, you know, property of the man. And then we thought, well, we get to pick a partner and it should be based on this love and sex and connection. Well, it's like what we're talking about is the honeymoon phase, right? That everyone goes through at the beginning of a relationship.
No, not everyone, actually. There's many people that start lukewarm and become hot later. That is also a myth, that everybody starts with a tremendous amount of erotic enthusiasm for their partner. Some do, but many don't. But we don't say it out loud because the myth says that there should be a honeymoon phase.
Okay. Well, so those are people like in arranged marriages, or they're making their own arrangements in their head, and they think, well, I'm not attracted to this person, but they're going to be a great provider. So that's not important to me right now to have that kind of desire.
That, or I feel deeply emotionally connected to you. You feel safe to me. You will be good to me. You will not hurt me. You will care for me. And, you know, and the fact that I am not as drawn to you physically or feel compatible with you physically is secondary at this moment. My erotic needs and my emotional needs are not aligned, and I am letting my emotional needs be the decisive factor. It's fine.
But is it fine? So how important is sex in a long-term relationship?
It may be very important for that very same person, but maybe the emotional need superseded. And you have to be, you have to know that. You have to understand that. You know, that same person who made that choice may have been fine for 10, 15 years sometimes. And then that other dormant part of them resurfaces, you know, with a vengeance and says, and what about me? But that doesn't mean that there was a wrong choice that was made at first. There was a choice that was made for different reasons. And those things, we have the idea that sexual needs and emotional needs are one and the same, and they always go neatly aligned together. And that is not necessarily the case. There are people with whom we can have wonderful sexual encounters with whom we would never want to live a life. And there are people with whom we want to live a whole life, but we have to mourn a kind of a erotic flatness that for some of us is a real dear loss.
So how do we reconcile? I mean, I know that a lot of your work is getting couples to reconcile this and to understand how, the importance of sex, how they can either get it back. You know, we had it at the beginning. That's what I hear a lot. At least they had, even if they had it for a week, even if they've been together 20 years, that first week was amazing and they all want to go back. And I would say, you're never going to go back, but what do we do? Like, can we experience desire and deep love at the same time?
Yes. Yes. Of course, some of us really do. The way I organized it in my head was actually based on the work also of Stephen Mitchell and others. It wasn't just my original thinking, that we all have two fundamental sets of human needs. And we need security, and we need safety and stability and predictability. But we also need adventure and novelty and risk and mystery and sometimes danger. The degree to which these two organizing needs, existential needs in our life, live inside of us will tell you the answer to how important is sex. When you say how important is sex in a long-term relationship, my first answer to you is for whom? Tell me the story of that person and who that person is, and I'll have a better sense of how to answer that rather than some flat generalizable, you know, number. And each of us straddles these two fundamental needs, you know, and they change in the course of our life. So, you know, some of us will find that the place where we love is also the place where desire feels very free. The safety I feel with you is what unleashes my erotic self. I ask this exercise a lot, where I ask people, separate the page in two. When I think about sex, I think of. When I think about love, I think of. When I am wanted, I feel. When I want, when I desire, I feel. And when I think about desire between you and me. And then on the other side, when I think about love, when I am loved, when I love, and when I think about the love between you and me. And then you look at the connections. For some people, these two seamlessly flow together and one flows from the other. And for other people, they are rather separately and disconnected. When I love, I feel deeply responsible. When I desire, I want to be free of all responsibility. It's that dance that every person has to explore for themselves. Then, how do you bring them together? You tell people, it's not the desire just for doing sex. Desire and the erotic, you know, I think that that's what frees people up. Is when I say, we're not talking about sex. You right. can have sex 3 times a week and feel absolutely nothing. I am not there to help you do it. But I will explore with you, where do you go in sex? What does sex mean for you? What parts of you get expressed in sex? What is it a vocabulary for you? When I go into that frame, it becomes a different conversation. Women have done sex for centuries and felt nothing. So desire is not the desire to do it. I ask an audience, if you've been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life, either because you were the child of a parent who was unfaithful or who left, or you are the offspring of an illicit love affair or accident, or you are the friend who's the confidant of someone who's either been betrayed or is in the throes of an affair, or you're the third person in the triangle. 80% of an audience will tell me they've been affected by infidelity. So this is not just a few rare rotten apples somewhere else. And that's when I said, this is touching us so much. So many people have been affected by this all over the world. The book is in 30 languages and I've been in 20 of those countries. I want to find a way to talk about it in a way that's going to be more helpful for all those who've been hurt by it or who've gotten lost by it or who destroyed their entire lives because of it. There must be something that is less of a black and white model that embraces the complexity of this very complex thing called adultery that has existed since the day marriage was invented.
Yes.
And not to condone it, not to condone it. I think that's a very important piece to add to it, is to really help people with it rather than just right. say if it's good or bad.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you do help people with it so much. So I just recommend that everyone read State of Affairs, because people have this notion, well, if someone cheats on me, I'm gone. I'm out of the relationship, right? And so it doesn't have to be that way.
Right. And Emily, and that if you stay, that you not experience it as a shame. If I had, especially as a woman, the new mandate for the woman is to leave. But, you know, it's not always so easy. Life is complicated. People have children who need two parents. People have economic realities. People have elderly parents living with them. It's not just so easy to get up and go. Right. And sometimes it's not easy to get up and go because you still care about the person, and because the very person who cheated on you may even also have been the one who took care of your elderly father or your alcoholic brother that is a mess and that has come to live with you for the past 2 years. This put it in the pandemic context.
Yeah.
You know, so don't be ashamed over the strength of staying. It demands a lot to do that too. But get help. But there is hope. This is not the only form of betrayal in a relationship. It's all of that.
How do we retrain the brain to understand that pleasure is our birthright and not just a reward? Like, I think there's so much about sex and eroticism that we just think we don't deserve it. Do you ever?
So yeah. The way I work with it is very experientially. And I don't just retrain the brain, I retrain the physical experience, the embodied experience, which then will send messages to the brain. So I work a lot with water. What is your preferred temperature of the water? I want you to send in the shower with mm-hmm. the perfect temperature for you. And then I want you to notice, what is the place on your body where you enjoy it the most? Is it the nape of your neck? Is it the back? Is it your head? You know, is it your shoulder? Is it the front? You know, and then I want you to just stay under the shower. And for as long as you can, notice the soothing, pleasurable quality of that water. And if at some point you begin to think, oh, I should turn, I should move, I should wash, I should finish, see if you can extend it just another 30 seconds. You see, you can do it alone. You can do it with the partner watching. These are all transposed metaphors of experiences around pleasure. Imagine that you're eating and your partner is just watching. And you're pleasing yourself. You find the thing you like the most. So I work with food a lot. I work with fruit. I work with water. I work with fabric, with clothes. you know, that you experience on your body. What, you know, I work with touch. Do you want hovering touch? This is from the work of Jaya. Do you want, you know, gentle touch? Mm-hmm. Do you want straight touch, or do you want stipple touch? You know, there's a beautiful exercise, another one, that is really the difference between giving touch and taking touch. So the giving touch, I give touch to you. I stroke your hand and I am thinking of you and my mind is completely focused on you. This is a great retrain exercise. And then there is the taking touch, which is now I continue to stroke your hand, but this time I'm focused on me. It's how I enjoy. It's the contact of my hand. And you can see people completely change the way they touch. Now I am using your hand for my pleasure and I am taking touch. And now I go back to thinking about you. Mm-hmm. And now I am giving touch. And to the distinction that the pleasure, you know, of giving is a different kind than the pleasure of taking.
Next, Nikki Glaser, who talks all about orgasms and porn.
Do you believe anything about this, like, addictiveness of the orgasm? And also, I read this, let me be honest, I read like 4 pages of Cupid's Poisoned Arrow about the female and male orgasm and how it, like, ruins our relationships and how women get super depressed after them and how you shouldn't be having them all the time. Do you know about any of that? And have you heard of people?
No, but I think women should. All I know is I go back to, you know, eons ago when women were actually, if you look at the tantric sex and you look at all these practices around women, that women, the orgasm, when we have an orgasm, it gives us life. It's our life force. Women can have up to like 226 orgasms a day, and that's fine. Men would be better off in this paradigm of limiting their ejaculation and or orgasm with ejaculation, and then learning how to have multiple orgasms through bringing the energy of the orgasm through their body. So that's a whole nother practice. Can I just ask you, do you have orgasms with men every time?
Yeah, if it's done right.
During penetration?
You know what? Not if I don't also have a vibrator. If I have a vibrator too, it's guaranteed. And I'm not always guaranteed with a vibrator by myself though. That's the thing. I need both the man and the vibrator for a guarantee.
Yes.
Now, if I'm by vibrator alone, I'm about 75% I can get there. If I'm with a guy alone, also 75%. But guaranteed with both. So when guys are insecure about toys, I'm like, I can't without you either. I need you. You're a part of this for me.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It's like bringing them along with the experience. I find that the guys who are insecure at the thought of it. But once they try it with you and they're like, that's really hot.
And they like the feeling of it.
Guys like it on their shaft too.
So much work. Like, I need a lot of pressure and I need a lot of stimulation because I'm just kind of like numb down there. And that's what's so good about listening to you is like, you've reminded me, like, think about your vagina, like go there. And I just don't feel like my body. I'm like shut off in places. And that's one of them. And now I'm just starting to like, just go to what feels good, both for sex and have no like shame about it. My favorite porn is women doing feats of like, that still feel good and don't hurt them. Like, I don't like multiple penises in one hole. That is not cool. Like for me, at least, because I picture myself and I'm like, ow, that would like hurt. Although if like a hand, I don't know why I can kind of accept that more. Usually because they do it like in a methodical fashion that like isn't going to hurt the girl. The stuff that I watch at least. But like multiple dicks, I'm like, I don't like it. But then like DP or like stuff like that, like where a girl—
double penetration.
I'm on the show and we're wrapping up and I go, what are you doing next? And guys like, I'm going to go DP in Florida with like a director of photography. And I know a lot of girls are DPing in Florida. I hear that's like a booming industry. There are a lot of female DPs now in your crew. And he's like, really? And I was like, do not get DP jokes. All the-. No, yeah. He actually was like, I hear this joke all the time. But I like stuff like, I like forced orgasms. Like that's my new thing. And because I didn't even know if it was a subgenre, but I found it on Reddit and like stuff on there. I'm like, I just like girls being like forced to come because I struggle to come. So if you tell me to do something, I'll do it. Like, but I like to like, I live my life very much like reward based. Like you don't get to have that unless you earn it. And so like, I want to earn an orgasm because they feel so good. I want to feel like, why am I getting this present? Like I did something like, I'm getting a sticker and then I can I push orgasms away because I'm like, nope, it can be better. I feel a better one coming and then I lose it. And I'm like, oh,
you do? Even with all the toys?
Oh my God, I push them away constantly. Like it is my instinct to not come. The first time I had an orgasm was, I was 21.
Okay.
And the next time that I was like regularly coming was 24. And then took a real.
I was like, 25.
You were 25?
Yeah, that's why I have this job. Because I'm like, what the fuck? I was like, I never had orgasm. So I never masturbated. I didn't even know it was a thing.
When did you get like wild? Like, when did you get like very like, I can talk about anything? Like, what was it for you?
Probably it was starting this podcast because I realized I didn't know anything about it. And I thought.
But what drew you to want to talk about it publicly anyway? Like when most people are like, I don't want to talk about that.
Well, this was like 15 years ago. And I honestly was like, why do I keep getting into relationships with guys where I'm faking orgasms? I'm not asking for what I want. I'm so into their pleasure over my own. Is this what sex is all about? And I literally thought I was the only person. I did. So I thought I'm going to interview everyone I know about their sex life and their relationship. And that's where the podcast started. Like in my living room in San Francisco, friends came over. I was like, what? And then I was like, oh, everyone,
people are so
many people feel the same way.
It,
but they're not. Yeah, they are. They still are. But not if we talk about it with our partners or anyone. The more we talk about it, the less weird it is.
I love talking about sex. And it's sometimes like kind of shocks people. Like I was just on this show and it's like we were setting up a shot and I was just waiting and someone was talking about they were reading books. And I was like, what are you reading? And he was like, oh, it's a book about tantric sex. And I was like, oh, my God, that's so fascinating. Like, what are you learning? And someone accused him of hitting on me. And I go, I asked him what book he was reading. He didn't lie. And I have an interest in sex. It doesn't mean that we are going to have sex. Like this, we can talk about this without it being like, oh God, this is inappropriate. But some people are, you know, triggered by that stuff. So I guess I should be more mindful.
And now All About Sex Scripts with Ian Kerner.
People come in kind of hopeless, and I really want to help them in that first session. So I kind of, over the years, have developed what I call kind of like a sex in action methodology, you know, where I kind of, I learn about the problem. I sort of look at it at the big, from the big picture perspective. I walk around it. And then in every first session, I will ask a couple, so tell me about the last time you had sex. And I do that because I believe that every sexual event tells a story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's a sequence of interactions that are, of course, physical, but they're also emotional. They're psychological. And you put them together, and that creates what I call a sex script. And I believe that most couples, especially ones that start to settle into long-term relationships, kind of have a sex script. And if it works, they're not coming to see me. And if it doesn't work, they are coming to see me. And there's something about the sex script that's reinforcing the problem that they're having.
Okay.
So I literally want to help couples rewrite their sex scripts away from the problem and towards pleasure.
Okay, so let's talk about this sex script, which you spend a lot of time unpacking in the book, chapter by chapter, with homework assignments in every chapter that really just, I mean, couples can take this at their own pace. I mean, they might find that just even in the first chapter, they stay there for a while after those homework assignments or the second chapter, because you give it, you give so much in this book. Like, I could just feel so much of yourself and so much of your years of doing this work. So let's talk about the sex script. How would you explain that? And also, is there a common sex script?
Interestingly, about 90 to 100% of my heterosexual couples, if I ask them, tell me about the last time you had sex, and I'm not using this like, oh, we're rewriting a sex script.
Right.
Like that's sort of what's in my head. I'm just asking them to tell me about the last time they had sex. Half the time they don't even remember, or they're arguing about when they had sex. Right. They can't even agree on it. But with heterosexual couples especially, I would say 90% to 100% either had intercourse in their last sex script or wanted to have intercourse and failed to. And if I asked most heterosexual couples, well, how long did it take you to get to intercourse? Most of my couples will say 2 minutes, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. If we're getting to 7 minutes, we're already getting extended. I'm not kidding you. I mean, I know.
Ian.
You know, so the sex script is so dominated by this one behavior.
We just go towards sex because it's pleasurable until it's not, right? It's
exactly.
Because I think this happens in most relationships. I really do. I mean, after a while, after the honeymoon phase is over.
The honeymoon phase is amazing because, you know, A, we got a nice little neurochemical cocktail backing us up. And B, there's so much excitement just in not knowing somebody and wanting to learn about somebody, you know? So
it's all new. It's all exciting.
It's all new. It's all exciting. So you know what I love, Emily, is that once I explain it in these terms, every couple I meet says, we want more of that. We want that. We're ready for that. We don't have it. How do we get it?
Okay.
Right? That's the million-dollar question.
That is the million-dollar question.
So I think complicated questions really have simple answers. You know, I really do believe that. So I think it's important to engage in what I call the cultivation of psychogenic stimulation. That's the clinical term. And I think that there's two ways of doing that. I think it can be face-to-face, and I think it can be side-by-side. And by face-to-face, you know what I mean by face-to-face, Emily? You watch two little kids or three little kids, 5 or 6 year olds, playing in a playground. They're making something up. They have no props except maybe a twig to be a gun or who knows what, or a jungle gym to be a castle. With nothing but their imaginations, they're actually creating worlds and characters that have power structures that if we played those same games as adults, they'd be really hot. They'd be really charged, mm-hmm. you know? So face-to-face psychogenic stimulation is being able to not just pull out a vibrator, not just grab a set of handcuffs. It's really being able to reach into your own psyche and begin to share something that turns you on. And it's crazy to me that so many of us either can't do that, won't do that, think we shouldn't need to do that, or believe they don't even have those fantasies or don't know that.
Right. Yeah, we don't. I mean, this is what we hear all day, every day. People think, well, I hear what you're saying, Emily. We should talk about our fantasies or we should role play, but that's just awkward. We've been together forever. Like, they're going to laugh. Like, yeah, it's all those reasons. I can't, I won't, I don't have any fantasies.
But I agree. But so I'll sit down with that couple and I'll say, but listen, we've agreed that you need psychogenic stimulation. And I sometimes say, you know, we need a different on-road into arousal. Or we need like a different on-ramp, or we need an arousal runway. Those two terms, like an arousal runway and an on-ramp, people kind of like relate to those terms, you know?
It's a great one.
And I'll say then, you know, I think that we got to do some side-by-side psychological arousal. And that's really simple. I just want you to take in together some sexy media. I don't care if it's reading erotic literature aloud. I don't care if it's listening to an erotica podcast. I don't care if it's listening to audio porn. I don't care if it's watching ethical porn, which is always interesting because everyone will then say, ethical porn, and then that gets me to give them a whole nother spiel.
Exactly.
And deconstruct their ideas about porn. But like I said, complicated issues have simple answers. Yeah. Then taking something really sexy together with the shared aim of letting it get you aroused. Maybe get into a little mutual masturbation, you know, while it's happening, you know, like.
Let's say someone says, yeah, but porn is wrong, or it makes me feel bad, or it's against my beliefs.
Right. First of all, I can try and make it fun. I can try and make it like that version of the Newlywed Game. I can say, I want you to pick erotica or porn that doesn't turn you on necessarily, but you think is going to turn on your partner. And then that always becomes...
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, that becomes fun. They're going to start to tell me about the solution, right? So we've moved from problem to solution. My job then is to raise the temperature in the room a little. And around that solution, turn it into a fantasy. So, okay, so what does that mean? Like, you want him to desire you a lot more? Do you want him to say something? Do you want him to do something? Yeah, I want him to push me up against the wall and tell me he wants to fuck me.
Right.
You know, like, wow, okay, like that's it's not something he probably does, or it's not the way you talk about putting together the shopping list, right? So you sort of want to like want you or hunger for you or almost want you to be objectified in those moments, right? So I'm just working with them to build the fantasy
And then he might say, well, I don't know how to do that, or that feels weird, or right? And then do you give them tools to do it as well?
Yeah, I do, but I feel like the main thing that they need is permission from each other. Like once they've sort of talked about a little more, like it's okay to come up to me and just, you know, bite me on the neck. It's permission, and it's getting them to get in touch with their erotic self. So sometimes people will come back and say, yeah, I picked out the porn for him. It was a POV of a blowjob because I know he loves blowjobs and I hate it. Why is everything a blowjob? Well, that's interesting. Do you like blowjobs? Yeah, I do. He'll say, yeah, I really do like blowjobs. So is it simply because it's a lubricated mouth with some friction of a hand against your penis? I mean, that could be just you masturbating, right, with some lube and your hand. No, I like it because it makes me feel like she totally loves me, or it makes me feel like I'm totally in power. Oh, it makes you feel like really loved, or it makes you feel powerful, right? Then we're getting to even a sexual behavior or a body part. It contains an erotic element. It contains an element of fantasy. So when people think about fantasy, they're getting way too ambitious. They're feeling like I have to be like so super creative. You realize there are so many paths to pleasure, first of all. So I'm not going to ever, I hate when couples get so hung up on
blowjob.
One.
I agree. You know, I'm like, let it go. Do something else.
There are so many paths to pleasure. The other thing that I really try and do is say, anything you do, whether it's a blowjob, whether it's intercourse, whether it's a kiss, it can have some kind of psychological meaning. It can be the most loving, romantic kiss. It can be the most passionate kiss. That oral sex can come from, and there's really like a mutual flow state being generated. And I think that's what every couple needs to have happen during sex, right? You need to get really turned on psychologically, and then you need to kind of shift into a kind of like flow state together where you're just totally present in the moment. So that's one lesson that I just learned from working with people who practice.
Oh, I love it. You describe that so well in the book about that state that we get into. And that's why people often like power play, because you are not in your thinking about the laundry and worrying that someone's coming, about your body. You're engaging. It's forced engagement, because a lot of us are not as connected during sex. We're not connected to our partner. We're in our heads. We're disassociating. So it's that flow state. I mean, I think we all want the flow. I want it when I'm writing or when I'm on the show. Actually, I have it when I'm on the show, but in other areas, it's just so hard. So do you teach couples this, or it's more like a theory of...
I do. Yeah. I do. So the technical concept for being in a state of flow when you're with another person is called entrainment. Okay? Like when you're pushing someone on a swing, you get into a state of entrainment. When you're throwing a ball with somebody, you get into a state of entrainment. When you're dancing and you're not thinking about the steps, you get into entrainment. When you're a good musician and you're playing, you get entrained, right? So it's actually a brain state. It's like getting on the same frequency with someone via something rhythmic. So, you know, like a lot of artists or writers say they do their best writing when they're walking, right?
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? Not sitting
Same.
Down, they're actually walking.
That's what happens when I walk. I have my best work, best thoughts about the show. Right. Yep.
So there's something about rhythmic entrainment, right, that gets you into like that flow state. It's rhythm combined with either a process with yourself, like I'm brushing my teeth and I go into a daydream, or with someone else. So the essence of sex, Emily, is getting into that mutual flow state. It has to happen for both.
And you have
partners.
A great chapter on entrainment. We don't have to give the whole book away, but I think you explain it really, really well there. And I was thinking, going, yes, that's what I want. I want my partner to read this. You know, it's like I've had it. Or how do you have it more often than not? You can't guarantee that every time you're going to be in entrainment.
No, you can't. But in the book, I just give lots of little exercises that incrementally help you build up. I call it entrainment training, basically. And there's lots of little ways of doing it and getting there. And ultimately, so the ultimate thing about a sex script is you want like all of the novelty and the eroticism at kind of like the front end. I mean, that's why kink is so powerful, because it gets you both physically and psychologically engaged, right? So it really cloaks the experience in something psychological. But then you kind of want to go into just that state of flow where you're not thinking. So it's nice to have a script that works because then you kind of encode that routine.
Wonder how to find your or your partner's G-spot? Deborah Sundahl has the answer in this top moment. Okay, listeners, this might be a little repetitive, but Deborah, say I'm at one of your workshops. How do you actually help vulva owners find their G-spot?
I take them through like a meditation practice to slowly identify the head, the body, and back of the prostate with their finger. I'm like, you saw it now with your eye. Now slowly go around the meaty area that surrounds the urethral canal. Put your finger very slow, very tender. Everybody wants to rub it and go really fast. It's like, guess what? Millimeter by millimeter, ever so slow. Well, everything changes when you do that. And from the urethra, then you go with your finger slowly down to the vaginal opening. That's all the prostate under that tissue there. So it's just at the opening. Mm-hmm. And just 2 inches in, what is that? That's the first knuckle.
Yeah. People think it's so deep.
That's a knuckle and a half.
Yeah.
Right? We're going way in there and pounding away at her, like, no! Right.
This is what I've been saying for years. They're pounding, pounding. It's not deep inside. It's out of the belly button. It is 1.5 to 2 inches inside, and I think people are still even going right in. They don't get what that is, up to your knuckle. And when I discovered mine, I was like, oh, it's just right. It's literally like it's that, why we always say that come hither motion is because it's like going towards your belly button. It's like that little, you just feel it's right there. It's like on the flip side of your clitoris. Like it's.
Yes, it's right there. We thought it was this tiny spot that somewhere in the deep oceanic recesses of the vagina was a spot. And some women had it and some women didn't. And only the right man will come along and find it for us and blast us off the planet. No, it's just a total myth.
It's a total myth. Oh, we got to find it first. People are like, oh, we got to teach sex ed. And when women come to me first, like, oh, how do I be a great lover? I'm like, first, you got to do the work on yourself. When you become a master of your own body and your own domain, then you can share that with a partner. Or you find a partner who's willing. And I love that in your book, Female Ejaculation and the G-Spot, you could do it with a partner. Like, there are tips in here how to do it with a partner. But if you don't have a partner, your partner's not in, I think it's less pressure, perhaps. It's on your own. So now we're inside and we've seen it peek out. And then you're just saying we touch it with a finger, then you'll become more.
Yes, because it's a process of awareness. Once you know and see and have felt with your finger, okay, I saw this G-spot stick out. Now I shut my eyes and I locate that with my finger. I feel what it's like to touch it with my finger. And I feel what it's like to have a finger touch my G-spot's body, right?
Yeah.
This is all awareness. I do not go fast.
Right.
I take women through this very slowly.
I don't think I even ever really looked at my vulva puppet in this way that like there's
your G-spot.
I never even knew my vulva puppet's G-spot.
I know.
We find our G-spot, no pressure orgasm or to ejaculate, but,
no,
but you found that
this is awareness.
Awareness. The first day is awareness.
We're finding it. We have a bit of a ways to go to orgasm yet. We have performance issues. We have impatience issues. We have to go really, we are trained to go really, really fast. We want that pleasure now. We want this now. It's like, nope. Okay, so we're articulating something that has not had a name. It doesn't exist. That is what I do. We're going to articulate this millimeter by millimeter. You will have no doubt about your G-spot after that. You will own her forever. That's empowerment.
Next up, Dr. John and Julie Gottman share some fascinating findings about compromise and relationship dynamics.
For example, this pandemic is changing people so dramatically, not only superficially, but at a much deeper level in terms of their values, in terms of what they dream about doing when they can finally get out, you know, in the world with safety. So sharing those thoughts And how your dreams have changed over the decades can be really a momentous conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. We do often share that when we start dating somebody, and maybe that's what even attracts you to them, that they have these dreams and passions of who they're going to be and what they're going to do. But then life gets busy and you have a kid and it is about the laundry and paying the bills. And slowly but surely, each one of you have little dreams that are dying. Like maybe every year they're just getting a little bit more repressed. And so to be able to talk about it and say, you know, this is still important to me. This is who I am. And I think this might be the antidote to, we always hear that couples grew apart. Well, we just grew apart. Well, this would kind of prevent that if you kept kind of monitoring. Well, we grew apart because I was going after my dream. I mean, I've heard this is sort of a cliche example, but well, I was home with the kids, but you were out doing this thing and you were out living your life and I didn't get to live my dream. So I guess I just love this idea of getting people to stick with these conversations that why you fell in love and what attracted you to each other.
Right.
It's so important.
Yeah.
Right. There is a huge myth out there. It's probably the most common myth about relationships, that you have to be compatible. And how compatible are you? But the reality is that, you know, if you're truly compatible, you're a clone of the other person and you get bored silly relating to them, right? So you really want to have a person who is different from you. And that is fine. That is great. The key to really having a successful relationship when your dreams are very different from the other person's is, do you support each other's dreams even though they're not yours? Now, there's going to be exceptions to that where your partner's dream is your nightmare. Well, okay, that's, you know, not going to happen probably.
I want to get back into conflict for a minute. And in relationships, because that's a lot of what we, you know, there's so many conflicts and there's so many problems that people just won't get past. They might not go to therapy. And I've always said, it seems like you're repeating the same things over and over. And then hearing your stat, 69% of conflicts are never solved. And in fact, they stay the same. So over years. So like, this is never going to change. But then yet we call these relationships still successful.
Right.
How is that possible?
Well, here's the thing. You know, the question about successful relationships isn't, do they solve all their problems? It's, again, how do they dialogue about those problems? How do they dialogue? Right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you were talking about compromise. Well, one of the things that is really, really important is taking the time to really understand your partner's point of view about a particular conflict and where it comes from, what it's about for them. What's the history behind that? Childhood history, other relationship history. Why is it so important to you that you have this particular position on the issue really lived? What is the underlying sense of purpose and meaning for you in having your position on the issue honored? And when you have that kind of conversation with one person as the listener and the other as the speaker, and that listener just staying with question after question to really understand the other person's point of view, and then reversing the roles so there's deeper understanding, then compromise becomes so much easier because you develop compassion and a much deeper appreciation for your partner's internal world regarding their position on a conflict issue.
Could you maybe give me some examples about how a conflict that stays the same, but how you kind of learn to zhuzh it so it works in a way?
Yeah, we call this the dreams within conflict. Mm-hmm. And we analyzed 950 of these conflicts that seemed like deal breakers, you know, where they're opposed to each other and compromise seems unthinkable because in these deal breakers, you're kind of selling yourself out if you compromise. That's the way it feels. And so after we analyzed that, and we also saw that in our own relationship as well, we found that some of these unsolvable problems become the points of better connection.
But you have that skill set of listening and teaching. I guess people learn this, they learn this from you, but we are not born listeners, right? Active listening.
Right. We really learned it from the couples in the lab who, you know, took these deal breakers and asked each other questions that deepened their understanding of their partner's point of view. Hmm. And Julie really is the one who was insightful enough to see that this was an important therapy technique because of her background as a therapist.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We will be back with more of this year's hottest moments. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. Of course, we had to bring back Dr. Bruce's fascinating insights on everyone's second favorite bedroom activity, sleeping.
Everything's been disrupted. Everything's been right. Thrown out of whack. And then to try to find order in this time of disorder and trauma for many,
right.
Our sleep is one of the first things that's going to go.
Right. Well, then before COVID, like how did sleep become the little black dress before COVID, right? And so here's what happened, right, is all of a sudden, several different things sort of collided. Number one, we could start tracking it a lot better. So now we've got rings, we've got wristbands, we've got things under our mattresses that can start to give us a little bit more feedback so we can start to understand more about our sleep. So that's certainly helpful. The other thing that we started to realize is that performance is really directly tied to sleep. All kinds of performance. So like financial performance, like how well you do at work, relationship performance, sexual performance certainly has got its roots in sleep. So, you know, when you start to think about all things performance related, we as a species seem to be kind of evolving towards this sort of high performance, high tech sort of universe.
Well, before you answer this, I do want to talk about how sleep impacts our sex life. But the first thing off the top of my head is that one of the most common questions I get asked over the last 15 years is, I want sex more often than my partner. What do we do? And then a lot of times it comes to, well, I'm a morning person. My partner's a night person.
Right.
How do we make that work? We're not home in the middle of the day, even though maybe we are, but still then, how does it impact our sex life?
All right. So this is the $64,000 question, as they say. So in my book called The Power of When, I actually took a look at this question because this is a question that I actually get asked on a very regular basis is what's going on here. So first of all, what we're talking about is a basic idea that I call chronotypes. So people may have not heard the word chronotype before, but you have heard of the concept if you've ever heard of somebody being called an early bird or somebody being called a night owl, right? Those are chronotypes. So originally we thought that there were three. There were early birds, what we called in the middle or hummingbirds, not the best of names, and then night owls, right? So I added a fourth chronotype to the literature. And so, by the way, these are genetic. So it's not like you happen to choose, hey, I want to be a morning person or this is actually something where we see a single nucleotide polymorphism, or what we call a SNP, on a particular gene, the PER3 gene. This is what actually has a lot to do with scheduling within your circadian system. So when you see the polymorphism there, it makes you an early bird or it makes you a night owl. So this is where it gets interesting. By the way, if this is one of these genetic things, right, and it's kind of inbred in us, you know, we want to figure out what that is. We probably want to be dating somebody that's the same chronotype as us, right? Like, wouldn't you want to?
Well, that should be, yes. I mean, I always say,
so
let's
talk
about
my question.
Yeah.
So here's my question. Why doesn't like Match.com or like eHarmony, like, why don't they ask these questions? Wouldn't there be a ton of sleep-related questions that you'd want to know about your partner before they became your partner, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, right, I'd want to know, do they snore? Do they like it warm or cold? What side of the bed do they sleep on? Like firm bed, soft bed? Like, there's a bunch of factors here, right?
Yeah, a snore and a soft mattress, we're done. Like, let's not even go out for drinks. Let's just call it there, right? I mean,
you see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah, see, I already
sleep
knew
is we'd critical. It's part of the human condition. It's all about the relationship. The core is sleep, for sure.
And you can't change that. So I always thought there should be a dating app for sex. Like, why don't we just lead with what we like? Is sex important to me? Am I someone who wants to prioritize pleasure? We should just do an app together. But you're
all right.
So,
all right. So let me answer the question.
Go. Yeah. Tell
How
me
does
everything.
It work? What do we know? So here's the basic answer to the question. When we look across chronotypes, right? You need 5 hormones to have successful sex to be elevated. You need estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. You need cortisol and adrenaline all to be high, right? You want all of those to be high. You want melatonin, the sleep hormone, you want that to be low, right? So we did a survey. 74% of people like to have sex between 10:30 and 11:30 at night. What do you think their hormone profile looks like? The opposite, right?
Right.
The melatonin
right.
is high and all the things that are supposed to be high right. are low, right?
Right.
So that's clue number one as to what might be going on here. And if you're in a heterosexual relationship, what do most men wake up with?
An erection.
Right. If that is not Mother Nature telling you when to use that thing, I don't know what is, right?
Right. Yes, I agree with you. You already got it going on. You got half the problem there, right? Half the problems are answered. Yeah.
Because you've got the elevation in testosterone there, so it makes a lot more sense. So a lot of times, you know, I have a lot of patients who say to me, you know, I like having, you know, intercourse with my partner, but he falls asleep afterwards all the time. And I want to like spend more time or whatever. And so I'm like, well, okay, well, what about morning sex? And I'm like, I'm being a sex doctor, not a sleep doctor here. But what I'm talking to him about is when they want to do that. And so that's really what we talk about. So I actually created a matrix in the book. So what do we do if an early bird is already married to a night owl, right? That's the big question. I had to create a matrix in the book. And in the book, I also have a matrix for lesbian couples and gay couples because the hormone profiles are different.
Wow, this is amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome,
what a great hack. Yes.
The science is incredible.
I love the science of it. And I love, because I actually want to talk about, too, the chronotypes. Go back to that. Your chrono quiz, you can find it at chronoquiz.com. That's chrono quiz.com.
Okay, so I'm going to give all of your listeners a 5-step plan
that
everybody can do, and it's not going to cost you a dime. And your sleep will be significantly better, okay?
Okay.
So step number one is to pick one wake-up time and stick to it. I would tell you, go to Chrono Quiz, figure out what your wake-up time should be, and do it that way. If you don't want to do it that way, that's fine. But figure out what your wake-up time is 7 days a week, including the weekends.
I thought
no
you were going to say
on,
that.
No, don't mess around. Circadian consistency, number one.
Got it.
Okay. Step number two, caffeine. Stop caffeine by 2 p.m. Why 2 p.m.? So most people don't know caffeine has a half-life of between 6 and 8 hours, right? And so if you stop at 2 and it's 8 hours because maybe you're a slow metabolizer, half of it's out by 10. It's around when most people are going to be going to sleep. So you want to have your coffee, have it in the morning, but stop by 2. Step number two, stop caffeine by 2 p.m. Step number three, alcohol, all right? Look, there's a really big difference between going to sleep and passing out, okay? Right? We don't like the passing out. We like the going to sleep. It turns out that there's a very important relationship to understand here. It's all about the time in which you have your last sip to lights out. Whatever that time frame is going to have the greatest effect on your sleep. So if that time is very short, it will have a very large effect. If that time is longer, it will have a smaller effect. So step number three is to stop alcohol 3 hours before bed. It takes the average human approximately 1 hour to digest one alcoholic beverage. So I figure you go to 2 glasses of wine, I'm going to give you a little bit of room for maybe a half a glass more. But to be fair, you don't want to go over 2. For most people, it gives them energy. It doesn't make them relaxed. And for men, it can make them aggressive. Mm. Step number 4 is exercise. Exercise daily. But don't exercise too close to bedtime, because like we were talking about, we want your body to cool down, not warm up. So stop exercise 4 hours before bed. Step number 5, this is going to help with brain fog in the morning. When you wake up in the morning, you should have a 15-ounce bottle or glass of room temperature water. You should grab it and you should drink it, walk over to the window and get 15 minutes of direct sunlight. Most people don't know, but in fact, sleep in and of itself is a dehydrative event. So you actually lose a full liter of water as you drink your water. And you lose a full liter of water every night just from the humidity in your breath. So you need to get that back in there. And then number 2, light that comes from sunlight. When it hits your eye, you have a specific cell in your eye called melanopsin cells. These cells will turn off the melatonin faucet in your brain, which will help you remove brain fog. Do me a favor, though. After you grab that bottle of water and you walk over to the window to get your sunlight, put on a robe.
Let's hear from Chelsea, Glenn, and Sade from Black Girls Texting. Okay, Chelsea, what's up? Tell me.
So I'm the relationship gal, and it's awkward because he can probably hear me. But we are in a long-term relationship. This is the person that I want to marry and have a family with. This is the person that I love. But I'm just like such a goofy person. Like, I feel like I wish I could like do a dance for him, but like, I can't. I would just start laughing the whole time. And I feel like the time when I'm like the hottest is probably when I'm giving him fellatio, because like I know what I'm doing. Other than that, I'm like overthinking it, like laughing because I don't know what else to do, but like, I want to be sexier.
Right. Okay. It's so funny because what is sexy, right? Is it what we see other people doing? But like, I love that you're asking this because it's really about finding, when do I feel the sexiest? So we know when you're performing, when you're pleasing him, that turns you on too. But I'm curious about your own relationship to your body and your sexuality. Like, do you masturbate? Do you get into your body? No, never.
No. So like the first time I masturbated actually was because Sade gifted me a vibrator and I tried it, but like I've never done it, you know, with my hands. Like, okay. I always have to use a tool.
That's great. Say, so many of us are in that boat. So there's nothing wrong with that. Did you have an orgasm? Did you have pleasure?
Yeah.
If you had to think about your hottest sexual moment in your whole history of sex, what's that for your hot, your sexual movie, your, what you fantasize about if you fantasize?
Well, definitely if I have like a specific like outfit on, I feel okay. More sexy, but then I just start like laughing, but maybe that's my sexy. Protection. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you ever dress up for yourself? Hear me out. Like in your bedroom, you got a mirror. Do you live with your boyfriend?
Yes. We live okay. together.
So maybe he's not there or he's out or you're in the bathroom, you're taking a bath and you put it on. And even though women, we've got things about our bodies, but hopefully, you know, we move past that. And how we move past that is just like, when we feel ourselves in the mirror and you look at your body and what it does, and, you know, maybe you're taking a bath or you're rubbing lotion on, and then you like kind of move for yourself and you practice, and maybe you give yourself an orgasm, you're in the tub, you bring your toy, play your favorite music, light your favorite candle, like all the senses, you get all the senses going because you got like the warm water on you, your playlist, maybe you have your favorite chocolates or whatever tastes delicious to you. And then you're just like, wow, I'm pretty fucking hot. Like I had an orgasm. Like take a mirror and like look at your vulva and be like, shit, this is fucking like hot, like mirror. And then you get to know, then you're like, oh, this is my power. Like it's in our body. We have to get it out. And then you'll just walk differently. You'll be like, I got this. It's just, that's why I sometimes, you know, they say like men pregame, but I'll pregame before sex. I'll be like, have my orgasms going, get in my body. Cause I'm tense. I'm like anxious, work, la, la, la. So then I just try to come down. And I like, before I even see someone that I'm dating, I'm like, I need to shower. I need my space. And you're living together too. So it's probably also harder. Cause you're like, I'm in my sweats now. And then I'm in my sweat. You know, you're just there. It's hard. It's a little bit harder, especially during the pandemic. So it starts with you and then exploring what has been hot to you in the past and why. And
I like that. Any questions? Getting sexy for yourself.
Yeah. It's such a vibe, Chelsea. It's like one of my favorite things to do.
Do you take nudes?
Yeah, taking nudes is really hot. So when you take a nude and you learn your body, like I know it sounds, but all of it's awkward. Like we all have these roadblocks, but once you take one step and you're like, okay, I'm going to take pictures. The girls told me I could take pictures, right? What do you guys get from taking nudes? Like what's, tell. Yeah.
Oh my God. I remember when Sade and like another one of our friends were always taking nudes of each other. And I thought it was ridiculous. And I was like, oh my God, why would you take naked pictures of yourselves and have them on your phone? That's scary. That's terrifying. And then they like hooked me up with a photo shoot one time. And I literally felt like the baddest bitch alive. Like it was, I felt so fine. Like I was looking at those photos, like, look at my ass, look at my body. And if only for me, I don't have to send them to anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, but remember when I joined and I was just laughing the whole time?
Yeah, you were.
Like, is it possible that some people just aren't sexy?
It sounds to me that perhaps the laughing is sort of it's because maybe you're uncomfortable with it. It doesn't feel like you, or it doesn't feel natural. Or maybe you grew up in an environment where it wasn't okay to talk about sex and it was always a joke, or your parents shut it down, which is very common. And so like, they'd be like, cover your eyes or, you know, so then... Or it's a joke, or maybe you had older brothers who are like, I don't know, it's a conditioning, but you can undo it and ask your partner too. What does he think about it? Like, does he think it's cute that you let, I mean, I'm not saying, because maybe there's not, but it sounds like you're having an issue with it. That's really what it's about.
So there's so much power, I think, in having moments of sexiness and owning that.
Owning your sexuality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as Black women, it's particularly interesting because I feel like there's this hyper-sexualized like rhetoric around Black women, especially from like very young. And then it's like, oh, you know, body, big hips, big asses, big tits, like all of this voluptuousness. But then when a woman does step into her sexiness, we talked about this on an episode when Meg Thee Stallion made her now very famous song, WAP. Everyone lost their shit. And it's like, we can't talk about our wet ass pussies. What's wrong with
exactly.
that?
So let's talk about, because that was actually my next thing about, you know, your podcast, Black Girls Texting. What could I learn from you? What could we all learn?
I would say that we're just people. I know that's like silly, but like even just thinking about when I travel, right? I've been mistaken for like a prostitute simply because I'm Black. And nothing's wrong with being a prostitute or a sex worker. But like, it's just like those weird moments of like people putting something on you that might not be you. Like sometimes even thinking you're sexy when you're like the goofiest goofball like me, you know? So I don't know. That's one.
Yeah. No, absolutely. What do you guys think? What can we understand more? I mean,
that's a good point, Chelsea. Yeah. I also just like that idea of like having our right to pleasure and without shame. Yes. Like, I think that like we deserve pleasure sexually in all sorts of ways. Like I like to indulge myself in simple pleasures whenever I can. Like, I just think we've been denied of pleasure forever. We work so hard. We're owed. We deserve.
Yes. Pleasure is your birthright. And so much of the self-care movement and self-love and sexuality has been started by Black women, right?
Exactly.
I think for me, communicating and having the open space to have communication around sex across races is a big thing. So like I am notorious amongst the group for, oh, Sade, she fucks white guys. But I fuck all guys, for one. But two, a lot of times I would sleep with men that were not Black, and they would always be like, you know, I've always wanted to sleep with a Black girl, but I've been kind of like afraid and all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't need to know all this information. It could have just been an exchange. We could have had the sex and we could have kept it moving. I have been more open with some guys to like have the conversation and be like, why did you feel like you needed to say that? But sometimes you don't want to have to go through that, right? So I think it kind of piggybacks off of Glenn and Chelsea's statement of like, we're just people. We deserve pleasure. And like, even if this is like a little like fetishy moment for you, like really unpack that a little bit before you just go telling people.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's offensive.
I was just going to mention, Emily, something, a piece of feedback that we always get. People are always like, I can't believe you guys are so honest about like the sex that you're having, and you tell these stories, and they really appreciate that vulnerability.
Yeah.
And we think that's important. Like,
it is important.
Getting those stories out there.
Well, I always say that to women, like, be that friend that talks about sex. That's how we're going to learn. And then we can reinforce pleasure is your birthright. Like, I do that with, you know, all my close friends. I'm like, have you had an orgasm? Have you asked for what you want? We think women think we don't deserve it. We got to work hard and then maybe I'll deserve. No, we deserve it now. And we are better when we have more pleasure in our life. And now the hottest moments with dating coach Matthew Hussey.
If I could give people one piece of advice on meeting people in person, it's say something instead of nothing.
Okay.
Because so often we get in our heads and we think, I've got to say the perfect thing. I've got to somehow win this person over. I've got to seduce them with one powerful line.
Yeah.
But what most people actually need is a green light for an interaction, whether it's man or a woman.
Okay.
We need a green light for an interaction. We're looking for that cue from somebody else that it's okay to invest a little of ourselves. It's kind of like walking down the street. If you walk down the street and a stranger smiles at you, doesn't matter, man, woman, young, old, whatever. If a stranger smiles at you, in that moment, you're quite likely to smile back. And it's not that you didn't want to smile. It's that you were waiting for them to smile.
Right.
Because you don't want to be the weirdo smiling at the stranger and they don't smile. Now, a lot of us, by the way, this is what's kind of interesting about life is we walk down the street, we walk past someone and someone smiles at us. And by the time we've registered that they smiled at us and we want to smile back, they're already past
us. It's true.
Us.
Just have a smile on your face, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. But that's exactly it.
How do we do that?
By having a standard for yourself that has nothing to do with other people. If you have a standard of warmth, like I think about this a lot. Sometimes I told you before this, I'm introverted, right? By nature, but I've learned how to be an extrovert when I need it. And I'm a big believer in, before I go to a party, or I was just at an event in Connecticut where I was around a lot of people, even to this day, I have to sometimes really psych myself up for those situations because I'm like, oh God, I've got to go and interact with a whole bunch of people and do small talk and do this, that. Some of that is just the effort of it all and the fact that I don't love small talk.
Right.
Who does really? But some of it is ego too. It's, oh God, I'm going to be in this room and I don't know anyone. And am I going to feel special? And am I going to feel like I'm standing there and I don't know anyone? It's going to be hard to talk. There's still that kid in me that feels that way. Now, as an adult and as someone who does what I do, I also have the tools. So that's really handy. And one of the psychological tools I use for myself before I go into that room is I want to have a standard for the warmth that I give.
Okay.
That has nothing to do with how warm this room is. Because we go into a room looking for warmth, looking for someone who's going to unlock our loving, compassionate, warm, friendly side. And if we actually instead take responsibility for unlocking other people's warm, compassionate, friendly side, then we will have a magnetic effect everywhere we go. Instead of going to a room to be changed, we go into a room to change the room.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good practice. That's so true. Because I'm thinking about, we're talking about like dating, should you approach, should you not? And how approachable are you? Like when you go to a bar, I mean, back in the day before we were all obsessed with our phones, you'd be with a friend or you'd be looking around. You had to. You couldn't be on your phone. But now we're all on our phones. You don't even realize that your body language is shutting off. You're not approachable. So people are like, oh, no one ever hits on me. No one ever talks to me. And I think, how do we recognize what we're doing that's making us not very approachable? And how do we become more so? We want to meet someone.
I do think that we have to almost reverse engineer it and say, what are the things that when people do them make me feel endeared to that person? What makes me feel like I'm comfortable with another human being? And then really look at yourself and say, be really, really honest. Am I doing any of those things when I walk into a room, you know, or when I go into a restaurant with a bar? Am I looking up? Like simple things. Am I actually looking up and at the room? Or is my head in my phone? And we know most people's heads are in their phones, not because there's anything that interesting there.
It's really not.
It's because it's a comfort blanket. It's smoking. You know, it's like smokers kind of look cool and indifferent because they always have something to do. People on their phones, it's the same thing. It's like, no, I'm not. Look at me. I'm not a loser. I have something to do.
Right.
I'm checking Instagram posts of people I don't know.
Exactly. Do you ever look some around and everyone's on their phone and they're always on Instagram? Like you just look to the left, to the right.
Yeah, because it's, you know, I'd be the last person on earth to say how addictive it is. But I'm getting lost in this mosaic of lives and stimuli and colors and patterns and aesthetics and moments, none of which are my life, none of which are the room that I'm actually right. in, none of which are the people that I'm actually surrounded by. You know, you've got someone who is surrounded by other people, but looking down in their phone saying, I can't meet anyone. It first is about lifting our gaze to the world that's actually around us, to the world that we're actually inhabiting, opening up our body language to the room. What we do is we go and find a corner of the room or, mm-hmm. or a table, and we close off to the room, and everything points inwards, and we close our space down. Yeah. We're in this big room with lots of people, and then we close our space yeah. down and our energy down, and it becomes a really brave thing someone has to do to come over, turn you around, lift your gaze up yeah. from your phone, and try and say something.
Right.
If the way that you are with your body language and where your eyes are looking and what you're doing is something that requires someone else to be disproportionately brave to come over, that's why you're not being approached. Right. You want to lower the amount of bravery required for someone to talk to you. People invest based on how much they like someone, and you shouldn't invest based on how much you like someone. You have to invest based on the mutual exchange of investment
okay.
that's happening between you. Invest in someone who invests in you. Now, look, in the beginning, someone has to move,
right?
You can't just, if you sit around and say, I'm just going to wait for someone to invest in me, then you can have a stalemate.
Right.
Someone has to move. Someone has to say, hey, how are you? And then, right. oh, we have a conversation. Someone has to say, should we go out sometime? Oh, one of us asked the other one on a date. Someone has to say, I like you, before the right. other person says, I like you, and so on. There's always got to be someone who steps in.
She's
closer.
Moving it forward.
That's fine. That is a very small form of investment, but then you test, you invest and you test. You see, if I move forward, do you move forward? Or do you stand still? Or do you move backwards? And come to think of it, why do I find you more attractive when you move backwards?
Why though?
What's going on with me? Right. Groucho Marx said, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member. Contained in that is the problem with most people's yeah. confidence in dating. You like me? There must be something wrong with you.
Right.
You don't want me? Well, now we're on to something.
Yeah. Right.
If they're not into me, it must mean they're more valuable than me.
Right. They're more valuable.
So I'm going to go after them. Or it must mean they're scarce. We want what's scarce. We value highly what is scarce.
Next up, Logan Urie breaks down the most common dating types and how to know if you found the right person. Tell me about what you label as the different kinds of daters, the three mm-hmm. kinds of daters. And we could start there. You guys, look for yourself in these descriptions.
Yeah, yeah. So that's really one of my favorite parts of the book, is this framework called the three dating tendencies. And the story there is that as a dating coach, I had all these different people coming to my office, showing up on Zoom, and I noticed they're from all different walks of life, but they seem to suffer from the same set of dating blind spots. And so those are patterns of behavior, ways of thinking that are holding them back from finding love, but that they can't identify on their own. And so I categorize them into this thing called the three dating tendencies. And each one suffers from unrealistic expectations.
Yep.
And so first you have the romanticizer.
Oh, I love this. Okay.
Yay.
So
and the
good.
Romanticizer is somebody who has unrealistic expectations of relationships. So this is that friend of yours, or maybe this is you, who says, I love love. I believe in a soulmate. There's one person out there for me. I don't want to use the dating apps. They're not romantic. And they're waiting for the meet cute. They're waiting to go to the farmer's market and reach for the tomato at the same time as the guy. And then suddenly they fall into happily ever after. And the issue here is that the romanticizer thinks that once you're with the right person, a relationship's going to be effortless. And that's just not true. Relationships require work. And even the best relationships do require that constant effort and attention. The second type is the maximizer. And I'm a maximizer. Many of the clients I work with are maximizers. And these are people who have unrealistic expectations of their partners. And this is the one who says, I like my girlfriend, but could I be 5% happier with somebody else? Or my boyfriend's ambitious, but could I be someone who's 5% hotter or 5% more interesting? And it's always what else is out there? How can I do better? and they're constantly looking for the next best thing. And the thing about the maximizer is they feel like I can research my way to the right answer. If only I can see every possible option, then I can make the perfect choice. And so the issue with the maximizer, as I'm sure you know, is that you can't date everyone. You can't turn over every leaf. At a certain point, you have to say, this person is great. I'm going to commit to them and I'm going to make it work. And it's not about finding the perfect person and then it's easy. It's about finding somebody great, investing in them, and then building that relationship. And then the last one is the hesitator. And I have to tell you, hesitators are really having a hard time during the pandemic because hesitators are the ones who say, the thing about the hesitator is they have unrealistic expectations of themselves. And so there's the ones who say, I'll be ready to date when I lose 10 pounds. I'll be ready to date when I have a more impressive job title. And with the pandemic, that's given them a lot of excuses not to date. And so for the hesitator, they think, I'm not lovable yet. I need to make all these changes to myself and then I'll be ready for somebody to love me. But they really underestimate two things. And those are one, dating is a skill and you need to get out there and get better at it. And if you're not dating, you're not getting better at dating. And two, you need to figure out what type of person you want to be with. And if you're just sitting at home trying to, you know, improve yourself, but not actually dating, then you're not figuring out what type of person makes you happy. And so the advice really for the hesitator is to don't wait, date. It's just to get out there. You'll make some mistakes. You're imperfect. The person that you're going to wind up with will be imperfect. And don't sit around waiting to feel 100% ready because there's no such thing.
Did you find anything split by gender? That there was more men who were more likely to be maximizers or more women or romanticizers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And honestly, as I've been doing more interviews for my book, one thing that's come up a few times that I actually feel really proud of is I've done interviews with a bunch of young women in their 20s who are like, I liked your book because you didn't say to women, pretend to be something you're not, play games, pull back, don't have sex until this date. And they were like, I feel like every single piece of advice in your book is for everyone. It's not very gendered. And I was like, I didn't even realize that, but that's how I feel. A lot of this stuff is universal. It's like, be a good person, have integrity, find somebody who's reliable, don't get distracted by the spark, give somebody a chance. And I don't think that those gender rules are relevant. Obviously, there are some differences. And in the book, I talk about fertility and men can have kids way older. And there are some things there that are frustrating. But mostly, I feel like men and women benefit from the same advice, which is be a good person and know yourself and find somebody who's a good person who knows themselves.
Exactly, Logan. What I found now after so many years of doing this is that it's really not about gender. No matter who you're sleeping with, your gender identity, it's behavior.
Yeah. I mean, I can say, I think in general, women probably have a slight more tendency to be romanticizers and women are more likely to consume Disney movies and Disney princess stories and rom-coms. And so there is more of a story in women's head around the meet cute and the narrative and what am I going to tell my friends? And then I would say men maybe tend to be maximizers a bit more, more focused on the research, more focused on the quote unquote objective right decision. But in general, the patterns that I describe in the book are about human behavior versus gendered behavior.
Right. So let's talk about how you know, how you pretty much know when you've met the person that you should maybe commit to.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I do think many people are maximizers. I think our culture creates really a feeling of maximizers because I talk about this in the book, right? Before somebody goes on a trip, they're going to read every Airbnb review. They're going to look at TripAdvisor. They're going to look on Yelp. And it's this feeling of the right answer is out there. I just have to research my way through it. And people crave this sense of certainty and they feel like, you know, the objective right answer is only one Google search away. But that's just not the case in dating and relationships. You can't date all people. You don't know all possible outcomes. There is a point at which committing to somebody is a leap of faith. And so the 37% rule, which I'd love to talk your listeners through, is basically something that I share with maximizers. And so maximizers are like, well, I've been dating my boyfriend for this many years and he wants to get married, but I'm just not sure because I don't know what else is out there. And so what I like to talk to them about is this concept called the secretary problem. And this is a sort of a mathematical riddle. And so here's how it goes. Imagine that you're hiring a secretary and you know you have 100 possible candidates. You have to interview them one at a time. And each time after you go through a candidate, you say yes or no. And so at what point do you choose your candidate? So let's say you choose too early on, you don't know what else was out there. If you choose too late, what if all the good candidates came before and there's nobody good left? And so what they have found is that this is what you should do. This is the mathematically correct solution. You talk to the first 37 people, and after that, you say, who was the single best person among that group? That person is now your benchmark. The next time that you find somebody who's as good or better than that person, you hire them on the spot. And so with dating, and this is an idea from the book Algorithms to Live By, they say, well, who knows how many people you're going to date? Can't come up with that number, but let's just say for argument's sake, you're going to date from age 18 to 40. Well, what's 37% into that age range? It's 26.1. So when you're around 26 years old, you've already dated 37% of the people. Come up with the benchmark from that first 37% and commit to the next person who you like as much or more than that first group. And when I say this to people, they usually freak out and they say, but I'm way past 26. What are you saying to me? Am I behind? And I'm like, you're not behind, but you've likely already dated somebody who'd make a great partner. The answer is not to keep researching. It's to figure out who was the best person you dated in those years. And now the next time you find someone who you like, realize how great they are, commit to them and build that relationship versus letting all these great people go because you always have one foot out the door wondering what else is out there.
And to wrap things up, let's hear from Serena fucking Kerrigan all about confidence.
Confidence is just, how would you describe it? Yeah, like it's a state of mind. It's a state of...
It literally spills into every facet of your life. And that's why it's so unfortunate that like we live in this capitalist society that is predicated on us feeling insecure. Because when we're insecure, we buy shit. Buy makeup, weight loss products, and women especially, like it's just like thrown in our face. And we are born with confidence. But if you really begin to treat yourself like your best friend, like that same kindness, it's not like you don't always love your best friend. You can not like your best friend one day or disagree with them or think that they could have done something better. But regardless, you will never be nasty or demeaning to your best friend. You'll always try to make them feel better, whether they're getting ghosted. You'll be like, fuck that guy. Like, right? That kind of dialogue is something that I literally say to myself in front of my mirror. Mirrors everywhere. And that is really how you do it. And it will spill into everything because when you're your best friend, if she came in and was like, I'm not like feeling sexy, like, what would you say to her? You'd be like, yeah, you're not sexy. It sucks. You probably suck in bed too. No, you'd never say that. You'd be like, okay, how do we get sexy tonight? Like, what should we do? Should we put on some lingerie, listen to Beyonce? So that kind of support you need to give to yourself. And it's exactly right. It's not about experience. You know, I think that that's a question I get a lot. Like, I'm not experienced enough. Like, so I'm not confident. I'm like, it has nothing to do with that. Because like, I wasn't experienced in starting a business or a card game, but that doesn't stop me from doing a great job. It's about having the confidence to do it and believing that you will get the hang of it.
Right. What was your steps then? You said like looking in the mirror and when those negative, because the limiting beliefs is part of the human condition, negative self-talk. And I think, you know, the suffering, most of the suffering comes from our thoughts. I would say
I agree with that. And it's about verbalizing them because if you got in front of your mirror and said half of the shit you're thinking about yourself, you'd be like, oh my God, that is so
right.
Fucking mean. You would never. So that's why I'm like, get in front of your mirror. Like, even when you're having a bad day, even when you're not believing in yourself, even when you like, you know, get fired, anything, get in front of that fucking mirror and talk to yourself like your best friend and see what happens. That's step number one. And this is something you have to do every day, every night, all the time. If I'm like walking by, like, you know, anything with a reflective surface, it could be a water bottle. You bet your ass I'm winking. It's a puddle on the street. I'm winking at that girl, right? Because I would wink at you or say hi to you if you were, you know, on the street and I recognized you. So why aren't we giving that same attention and love and recognition to ourselves? One, two, you can never speak badly about yourself. The way that you speak about yourself becomes who you are. So when I used to say, I'm the queen of confidence, and any press article from 2 years ago would have been like, Serena Kerrigan, the self-proclaimed queen of confidence. Now you look me up, it's Serena Kerrigan, the queen of confidence, because I manifested that for myself, that I literally, people will just react to how you present. You really do write the script of your life. And so if you were like, I'm the baddest bitch in bed, you become the baddest bitch in bed. That's just how it is. So when I hear like my apartment, like my company, like no one is allowed to speak badly about themselves. You can say a feeling because feelings go away. They're temporary.
So do you teach them the difference between that saying like, I'm feeling a little bit?
Well, yeah. bloated. I'm not feeling sexy, right? Feelings go away. They're temporary. I'm feeling sad, right? Like, you're not feeling sad yesterday. But when you say I am, that's it. Like, that's it. And I think it's so funny because growing up, I heard that phrase, like, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. I'm like, what were they smoking? Because words carry so much weight. I mean, like, we're storytellers. Like, that's what human beings are. So the way we verbalize things, and especially ourselves, is how the world will see us, because we decide it's us. We are the baseline. Like, there's one person that has been with you your entire life. And guess what, bitch? It's you. And that's it. So that is the one.
Yeah.
That's the one.
That's true.
So those were some of the hottest moments from this year. What was your favorite? I can't wait to see all the sexy memories that 2022 is definitely going to bring into our lives.
That's it for today's episode. See you on Friday. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. Be sure to like, subscribe, and give us a review wherever you listen to the podcast, and share this with a friend or partner. You can find me on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Sex with Emily. Oh, I've been told I give really good email. So sign up at sexwithemily.com. And while you're there, check out my free guides and articles for more ways to prioritize your pleasure. If you'd like to ask me about your sex life, dating, or relationships, call my hotline, 559-TALK-SEX. That's 559-825-5739. Or go to sexwithemily.com/askemily. Special thanks to Acast for powering the Sex with Emily podcast. Was it good for you? Email me, feedback@sexwithemily.com.